We spent much of our last session discussing the nature of halacha and agadah. What is the agadah? How do we relate to the agadah as a religious phenomenon, as a phenomenon that sort of structures Judaism? Because we have met for the first time in the Mishnah we read last time, that ona'ah, which we have been dealing with so far as a halacha concept, moves beyond that to become something both halachic and more than that. It is more than a legal concept because it becomes a metaphor. And which is not to say it is not still something of a legal concept, because even in the world of ethics, there is law. But I tried to demonstrate to you that ethics was not the same as law, even though sometimes it is. And it is not always the same. So we read in the Mishnah in 58b, that's 58b1 in the English, Kushem sha'ona'a v'mekak u'minkar, just as there is wrongdoing in buying and selling, kach ona'a b'dvarim, so there is wrongdoing with words. Lo yomar b'chama chefet zeh, a person should not say, how much does this item cost? V'hu eino rotze likach, when he really has no intention of purchasing it. Okay? So that was quite a shift from the rather strict halachic notion to a notion that is really somewhat different, where, in fact, before we saw in our study of ona'ah that intention was not the issue, that ona'ah was a way of either protecting the market or protecting individuals, and there was no necessary intent to defraud anybody with the laws of ona'ah. Here we see something that's really quite different, where a person in fact clearly intends to do something that's inappropriate, and yet it's not a strict halachic issue. This is an issue of human behavior and of counseling appropriate behavior. Imaya bal tshuva, another example. If a person was a penitent, lo yomar lo zechor ma'asecha rishonim, remember the way you used to be. In other words, if a person is now righteous, and he wasn't at one time, you don't say to that person, oh, I remember you when, and boy were you, you know. You don't do that. Because that's called ona atevarim. That is wrongdoing with words. Wrongdoing with words. Lo yomar lo zechor ma'aseh avotecha, shenemar. Oh, im hu ge'inger. If a person is a convert, you don't say to the convert, oh boy, I remember what your ancestors did. They ate treif and they worshipped idols and they did all these things. You don't say that to the convert. It's not appropriate. You have to be careful with the way you use your tongue. Okay? So that was the Mishnah that we did. Now, we then came to a baraita, which just, as baraitot frequently will do, filled out the Mishnah a little bit more. Okay, the baraita started the Gemara. I'll go quickly with this. Tanu Rabbanan, the rabbis taught, Lo tonu ish et amito. The Torah says, you shall not wrong a person his fellow. Right? That was one source. Now, if you want to look, by the way, one of the nice things about this particular art scroll edition of the Talmud, the Hebrew side of the page, reflects a rather modern effort to incorporate a variety of commentators, some of which are somewhat new to the traditional text. And one of the nice things that it has, if you look at the side of the text, I'm now 58b2, but on the Hebrew side of the page. Look along the side, and you'll see right along the margin, there are some sources here, which we have seen, those of you who have been in the Talmud class before, we've seen many times before, such as Masoret HaShas. Masoret HaShas is other places in the Talmud where a particular subject is also discussed. So every edition of the Talmud will have in the same place, the Masoret HaShas, other places where you can find this material. Below that, Hagahot HaBach. Hagahot HaBach are textual emendations from Krakow in the 17th century. Okay? That's also standard in a Talmud text. Underneath that, you have Torah or HaShalem. This is somewhat different. This you will not find in all Talmudic texts. And the advantage of this is if you look here, and now I'm on the margin, on the Hebrew side of the page, third, as it were, the third section down. It's called Torah or Shalem. The name is fairly irrelevant, the light of Torah, complete light of Torah. But it's of importance because what you have then is Aleph. You have an Aleph, a regular Hebrew letter Aleph. V'ger lo toneh, v'lo tilchatzenu, ki geri meyitim be'eretz Mitzrayim. You simply have quotations, full quotations of the biblical source being referred to in the Talmud. And just in terms of making reference, it's useful. It's useful. Sometimes the art scroll will bring that in an English translation. Sometimes it'll bring the Hebrew. But you have here, in this edition of the Talmud, under the rubric of Torah or HaShalem, all of these references of verses. So if you look at number bet, number two, lo tonu ish et amito, you shall not wrong a person his fellow, v'yareta melokecha, you shall fear your God, ki ani Hashem Elokechem, for I am the Lord your God. This is the source of ona atevarim, that you are not allowed to wrong somebody with words. Okay? Gimel, the next one down on the page. The chitim karumim karla amitecha, o kanomi yad amitecha. You have seen this before. This was the source of all of our laws of ona'a as far as transactions, monetary transactions are concerned. So that's if you sell a sale to your fellow, o kanomi yad amitecha, or you make a purchase from the hand of your fellow, al tonu ish et achiv, one fellow shall not wrong the other. Okay? So that we've already seen many times. But by putting these two things in juxtaposition, you can see that there are two different verses. In fact, in the Torah, they are not very far separated. If you look at the first one, and here it gives you in the small print here, you have to have good eyes for this, without glasses for some of us. It says, Vayikra Kaf Hei Yud Zayin. Okay? Leviticus 25:17. Look at the next one. The next one is Leviticus 25:14. So it's only three verses before. It was three verses before. Last week I read to you this whole section. The whole section has, in fact, nothing to do with this. Right? It had to do with a totally different subject. But that doesn't make any difference as far as the construction of the law goes. The law takes little pieces and constructs a vast complex of law that affects all of life. It doesn't matter necessarily what the original context was. It depends on how it's eventually used in the legal system. That's true of any legal system. It's true in the American legal system. It's certainly true in the Talmudic legal system. Okay? So, the second source number bet was the source that actually occurs second in the Torah text. Verse 25. Was that right? No, verse 17, as opposed to verse 14. Three verses later. So that's what's being referred to now at the beginning of the Gemara. The Gemara says, Tanu Rabbanan lo tonu ish et amito. That's to say, that verse source, which appeared second in the text, where no mention is made of monetary transactions. Mimekach o mimkar, no mention whatsoever of that whatsoever. It just is by itself, on its own, a counsel that you're not allowed to wrong another person. Lo tonu ish et amito, quote, ba'ona adivarim akatuv medaber. When the scripture comes and teaches that verse, it teaches a law concerning ona adivarim, wronging someone with one's words. Ata omer ba'ona adivarim. You are telling me now that that verse refers to wronging a person with words. Oh, eino illa ba'ona'at mamon. Why not say that that verse is referring to wronging a person monetarily? Oh, so then the Gemara goes on, the Baraita goes on. Kushahu Omer, no, when the Torah comes and the Torah says, V'chitim karumim kalamitecha o kanomi adamitecha. The Torah said now three verses before, when you sell something to your fellow, or you make a purchase from your fellow's hands. Okay? There it said, Lo tanu ha'etamitecha, you shall not wrong one another. There it's directly in the same verse in connection with purchase and sale. Hare ona at mamon amur. That particular verse refers to wrongdoing of a financial nature. Hamani mekayem lo tonu ish et amitoho. So what then do I understand the first verse to mean? The other one, the one that we've just quoted now, that doesn't mention any kind of purchase. Be'ona'at devarim. That refers to wronging in words. Right? Now, obviously, this is not... compelling, necessarily compelling. How would you know it refers to words? Doesn't say that. If it had said words, okay, I would know. It doesn't say that. So obviously, either there's a strong tradition that always has taught that particular interpretation of the verse, or this is a tradition that develops concurrently, and the rabbis are now trying to find a source for it in the Torah. Impossible to know one or the other. Right? But now we see that as far as the Baraita is concerned, these two verses refer to two different things. And now in this Mishnah, we are concerned with wrongdoing with words. Right? Now the Baraita gives several examples, some of which we've seen already in the Mishnah, but some of which is expanded beyond the Mishnah, as is common now in a Baraita. Haketzan, tell me, give me an example of what you mean. Im haya ba'al tshuva, if a person was a penitent, al yomar lo, one should not say to him, zechor ma'asecha rishonim, remember what you used to do. Right? Don't do that. Im haya ben gerim, if a person was the child of converts, al yomar lo, zechor ma'asecha avotecha, remember the deeds of your ancestors. Im haya ger uvalil motora. Now this one we haven't seen in this form, you'll see. If a person is a convert and comes to study Torah, al yomar lo, you shouldn't say to that person, pesha achal nedelotu trefot. A mouth that has eaten such tarfus, that had ham sandwiches a whole life. Alright? That person, Balil Mod Torah, that same mouth comes to study Torah. You're not allowed to say that. Not allowed to say that because that's Ona Atavarim. That is wrongdoing with words. Balil Mod Torah Shenema Mipi Agbura. The Torah has been given from God's mouth. Look what your mouth had in it. Not nice. Don't say things like that. Im Hayu Yisarim Ba'im Anav. If a person, unfortunately, should suffer. Im hayu chalaim ba'imanav, if he were to experience terrible sicknesses, o shahaya mikaberet banav, or he were to unfortunately to bury his children. I don't know. In other words, a person has suffered terrible suffering. Al yomar lo kedero sha'amru lo chaverav le'iyov. Do not say as Job's friends said to him, halo yiratecha kislatecha. The end of that is what's crucial. Job's friends say to him, do you mean to say that somebody suffers without deserving it? Right, so that's a nice way to comfort a guy. A guy suffers. You're not allowed to say that. Maybe it's true, but you're not allowed to say it. You can't say anything. That is ona atavari. Yes?
Question. The word ona to me means deception. Clearly, cheating or deceiving. Now, all these examples are more like hurtful words.
Correct.
But not cheating or deceiving.
So I would say that you are speaking modern Hebrew, and the Talmud is not.
Yeah. Onah is more than just...
You better believe it. The Onah is what the text says it is.
There's a connection even.
All I can tell you is that this is what Onaa means. You are reading the definition of Onaa. You are not reading translations from English, as modern Hebrew frequently is. Okay? You are instead reading the source. This is the source material. Now, it's not the oldest source material. The oldest source material is the Bible. What it means in the Bible beats me. But I can tell you what the rabbis in the Talmud thought it means, and that's what we're reading right here. Okay? The rabbis of the Talmud, it meant, at least in this context, wrongdoing. Wrongdoing. And wrongdoing of a variety of kinds. Okay? Yes?
On the same question, which I wanted to ask a long time ago, in the biblical verses it says tonu. It never says the word ona'a, aleph, bab, nun, aleph, pei.
Correct.
It's always taf, bab, nun, bab.
Correct.
Why the Talmud people translated ona'a, aleph, bab, nun, aleph, pei, instead of hey, bab, nun, aleph, pei, which on is treasure. Ona'a, in general, in current Hebrew, is if you wrongdoing in financial transaction.
Well, that I can't answer. I'm really not sure of the answer to that because I'm not sure of the grammar that's involved. Honestly. Okay? But again, I don't think it's fair to take modern Hebrew as the example. Right? The key thing is here that it was clear to the rabbis when it says lo tonu. The noun that comes from that is the concept of ona'a. Ona'a. Okay? And it is simply trying to concretize for us what that means practically.
One thing I thought, and I really don't have anything to support, ona'a with eight vav nun aleph a, which is coming from wrongdoing with treasure, which is
from on,
is what you said to us previously, that there is no intention in that wrongdoing.
Mm-hmm.
Ona'a with aleph might be with the intention, and just in the biblical verses, mm-hmm. or in the Talmud, they just use one word, and they use the aleph.
Could be. No way to know, but it could be.
Grammatically, maybe, it just occurred to me, the ona'a with an aleph, maybe it comes from a different root, which is related to the word aven, aleph, vavun.
Definitely related to aven.
Which is pesha, or,
it's pesha, exactly. That is definitely related to the word aven.
It's
avon is different.
It was ayin, with aleph.
Anyway, this is with aleph. The word avon, which we commonly see, is with an ayin, usually. But this is aleph, vav, nun. Aleph, vav, nun, which is aven, which is a wrongdoing. Definitely, that's
correct.
Well, the etymology comes from, I don't know which comes first, whether it's aven that comes first as a noun. Then you have lo tonu, right, which is the same thing.
I think that tonu is what one is saying with a hey.
So it could be.
Well, maybe yes, maybe no. As far as the rabbis were concerned, the answer is that they understood that all of these things were connected. In terms of their sense of etymology, all of this was connected. Okay, let's go on. Alright, next. If donkey drivers were asking him, where can they find grain? A donkey driver, it's his job to carry grain. That's how he makes a living. So he comes to you and he says, oh, do you see any grain around that I can carry on my donkey? So I can make, I can get paid for it. You shouldn't say to somebody, go over to that guy, because he sells grain. At the same time that you know, that he never sold grain before. So you're just being a pain in the neck. Or you're being the kind of person who, some people always answer questions. You've got to watch out for them. You ask them a question, you mean it very seriously, give you an answer, but they don't know whether it's right or wrong. But because you trust them, you trust them, they always have an answer. So it could be that. That's not necessarily the intention to deceive so much or to hurt somebody, as to just show that you always have an answer to every question. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Af lo yitle nav ala mekach b'sha'a she'en lo damim. A person should not even put his eye on merchandise when he doesn't have any money. All right, so that's taking it, Rabbi Yehuda adds another level to it, that if you're looking at something and you're acting as if you're looking seriously, but in no way could you ever be a purchaser, then in effect you're deceiving the seller. You're putting the seller into a position that's just not real and it's not true. And that's yet another side of it. Okay, that we did until that point last time. Now we go on from there. Shaharei hadavar masur lalev. Now here the Barenta adds another dimension, which in fact has been implicit in at least the last thing that we read. The last thing that we read is this: the storekeeper doesn't know whether you have money or not. He has no idea about that. He assumes that everybody comes into his store is interested, and he can't go wrong. So how do we know that you're not supposed to do that? What's really wrong about that? This whole thing, at least this last example, is something that's masur lalev. It's internal. This is a way that you know. Somebody else doesn't, but you know. Right? It's internal. The whole davar masur lalev, anything that is literally means turned over to the heart. Or turn over to the mind, but I'm sort of freely translating it as an internal. It's an internal thought. Right? Anything like that, v'ne'amar bo v'yareta melokecha. The end of the verse, remember, lo tonu ish et amito. A person should not wrong his fellow. It ended, v'yareta melokecha, you shall fear your God. So the real one that is aware of what's going on is God. Wherever God is aware of it, it doesn't have to be expressed on the outside. God's also interested in the life of the inside. So that's how we learn Masur Lalev. This refers even to those things that may have no actions at all, but are internal states of awareness. And how do we know that internal states of awareness are being commended here? Because the Torah says, V'yareta melokecha. Didn't have to add that little piece. But since it says, you shall fear your God, it's a different kind of law. And every once in a while the Torah says that, and every case where the Torah says that, the Talmud goes into an analysis and analyzes, what if nobody would know? Well, it doesn't make any difference whether anybody knows because it says, V'yareta melokecha. Sometimes we say, look, it doesn't matter what you think, you should always do right. Most of the time we say that. And that's true. Let's say you want to do things that are really wrong, or you're doing them for the wrong purpose. You know, you're trying to just make a name for yourself, and you don't really care about the poor man that you're giving charity. And so, you know, is that wrong or right? Well, it's not the highest degree, but it's pretty good. Because the better you give charity for the wrong purposes than the right purposes. The most important thing is what you do and not what you think. That's the way we often do it. Well, it's usually true, but it's not always true. Some of these cases, the case of what you think, also comes to bear. How do we know that it comes to bear? Because the Torah says, V'yareta melokecha. You shall fear your God in these particular cases. Another one, for example, is the law of... Excuse me?
When we said, Kaberet avicha v'timecha, the second sentence says that v'yareta...
Is that? I don't remember.
Yeah.
Okay, very good. The one I was thinking of was... Mipnesei v'atakum v'adalta
p'nezakein. Yeah, maybe that's the one.
V'yareta melokecha. It says, you shall stand up before the old and give deference to the white-haired. You shall revere your God. So the Talmud says, in that case, it says, well, what if you don't mean it? Or what if we study this. This is in Masechet Kiddushin. What if you're doing it at a distance? What if you're not really, you know, you're doing one thing and you mean another thing? Well, that's no good, because it says in that case, V'yareta melokecha, you have to You have to do it in such a way that in fact the intent is a proper intent. Yes.
The Hebrew you just read in the sentence, we talked about later, I didn't catch the exact words, but is that the could be translated as inclination? In terms of having an inclination? Because I'm wondering, what's the difference between, is there a difference theologically between an inclination, a thought? I know there's a difference in terms of an. Seems to me in English that an inclination, is something that you can't do anything about. It may be just part of you. People have inclinations to be homosexuals or something, or thieves, or pedicures, things like that. But
come on, you're going good.
That's not my intent. I just want to know if the words of defining theologically what these words mean.
Yeah.
If there's a difference.
There is a difference because inclination, I don't think, would be what we were talking about. We're talking about something that we normally refer to in Hebrew as kavana, where you have an intention. And that is where, in fact, you have an intent to do one thing or another. And let's say the example that's brought here, the intention of going into the store and pricing an object when you can't buy it, that's an intention. I don't think we would call that an inclination.
But why do we say a prayer in the morning prayers to guard us from the inclination?
Because that's the English translation. The Hebrew doesn't say that. It says miyetzer hara. Miyetzer hara is not an inclination to do evil. Miyetzer hara is miyetzer hara. It's its own thing. Its own thing. It's as if there's something in us that drives us toward the doing of evil. And that I don't think is so much an inclination. Yes, sir.
The implication of the text is that you could overcome your internal urges.
Definitely.
Because God is watching.
Exactly. Exactly.
But what is the reason for that?
What is the reason for what?
What difference does it make if you are doing the right
mm-hmm.
thing?
It's a very interesting question.
For the wrong reason.
Because in religion, it is true that actions speak louder than words. That's true. It's usually true. However, to say that religion is simply a structure of deeds without being concerned with the internal state of the human being, I think would be to sell religion as something that it's not. Religion, in fact, seeks an internal transformation of consciousness, an internal transformation of awareness, and a purification in terms of what one's intentions might be. Of course, the question would be, how far can you go with that? How much is reasonable or possible? And I don't have a simple answer to that, but I would tell you that much of the life of the religious personality really travels around that question. And it is how to transform the inner being as well as the outer deeds.
So in order for that to be supported, you need to, if you're going to love your neighbor as yourself, you have to steer away from, even if you're doing the right thing, thinking the wrong thing, you need to conflict with that.
Well, that's why a verse like that, is you shall love your neighbor as yourself. It's a very interesting verse exactly because of this. Because on the one hand, what it seems to be counseling is a state of mind. All right? And yet one wonders, is it really counseling a state of mind only? Or is that a metaphor for certain ways of acting? Or is it both? You know, one, the other, or both of them together? So there's no simple answer to that question. It's a good question, and people will debate it to the end of times, hopefully. Yes.
Rabbi, I'm out of practice with the vocabulary on this, but when we're talking about the greater good being of deeds or of words, as I understood it, in the first good and potentially the greatest good would be good that is not done for any reason other than the wish to do good, because if it's to another end,
mm-hmm.
that demeans the good,
mm-hmm.
and it produces the purity.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's the right word,
mm-hmm.
of the the intrinsic value of right. goodness yeah. of the thought. Is that mm-hmm.
That's also true. That's another dimension of the interior life, let's say. The purification of interior life is to wean oneself away from the notion of external reward and rather simply the doing of a virtuous act for the act itself. Okay, but that's not quite as simple as I've just made it, because there is another point of view which doesn't, the notion of the act for the act itself, for the virtue of the act itself, may or may not speak to the reality of this particular system. That almost sounds too philosophical. I'll tell you why. Because the argument, I think, could be made that in Judaism that has no meaning. Acts have no internal, no explicit meaning in and of themselves. An argument could be made, I'm not necessarily making it, but it could be made that it is because the act is commanded by God that the act is a virtuous act. That goes back to the Euthyphro of Plato. Plato asks in the dialogue the Euthyphro, and this makes its way into Jewish discussions as well, is an act a desirable act because God commanded it, or has God commanded it because it is desirable? See? Yeah. It's a very, very good question that Plato asks. And we don't know the answer to that question. You know, one of the beautiful things about Plato is it's very rich to talk about.
The purest goodness would be for the God, the intention.
Well, just to give you the language.
I haven't read this in a while.
Let me give you the language that it is in the rabbinic literature. It is, do not do something al menat lekabel pras. Do not do something in order to receive a reward for it. That's the way it is in the Talmud. So, you know, if we move from there, well, let's say you don't do it for a reward. I'm just taking the next step. What does that mean? What does the purity of an act, purity of intention mean? And that's not as clear as I might like it to be.
Well, there are tangible benefits from doing charitable. For instance,
correct. Correct.
No tax deduction for tzedakah. Should you not take it? Does that make it less pure or less?
That's what I think.
Well, that's a good question. That's a good question. All right. No answer to that at this moment. Okay. But I would say that it is better to give charity for the wrong reasons than not to give charity. And that too, we have a concept. The concept is mitoch shelo lishma balishma. A person should do the right thing even for the wrong reasons, in order that doing the right thing for the wrong reasons will lead to doing the right thing for the right reasons. Okay? That's how it goes. Bitosha, lolishma, balishma. Even if you're doing it lolishma, not for its own sake, eventually you will do it for its own sake, which means for the proper pure reasons.
This was one of the big dividing points between Catholicism and Protestantism.
Yes, it was an issue.
In terms of whether the works counted
or
the faith counted.
This is a big issue in Martin Luther, between Martin Luther and the Church.
Martin Luther thought he was getting back to us by saying, forget about the works, okay, it's the faith that counts.
See, but for us in all truth, it's works and faith. Yeah. It's a combination of the two in that language. Very nice. Yes. I'm sorry. Yes, sorry.
There are functional MRI studies showing that the pleasure centers in the brain actually get activated at doing gifts of charity.
That's good. It's good to know.
one way of looking at this that I heard that I like very much is that since humans are created in God's image, when you look at another human or you interact with another human, to some extent, you should be looking for their godliness. And therefore, the way you treat them should have the same sense of awe, obviously at a different level, that you would bring to if you were in fact interacting with God.
Very nice.
And yep. I think that you know, that then sets a whole framework for thinking about these processes. And I think that we use the word term God-fearing, and I think that that has a little bit of that embedded.
Good, very nice. And that is a direct translation of V'yareta melokecha, you shall fear your God. It's God-fearing. Somebody else? Yes.
What justifies the ability of the human mind to decide what is favorable in the mind of God, so to speak, and what is not?
In theory, I have no idea. But in practice, it's what's in the good book. All right, because there is a place to look where you can see this kind of, at least a history of working this out. Not that it's the last word on the subject, but it is certainly among the first words. Okay, let's go back to the text. Amar Rabbi Yochanan Mishum Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai. Now here you're going to be, get ready, because you're going to see some statements here that may seem a little strange. Says Rabbi Yochanan in the name of Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, Gadol ana'at devarim me'ona'at ma'on. Amon. Verbal doing, saying something with words that is hurtful is worse than ona'at mamon, than wronging a person with money. Shezeh ne'amar b'v'yareta melokecha, because when we talk about wronging a person with words, it concludes the verse by saying, and you shall fear your God. Whereas the other one, namely wronging a person with money, doesn't say, you shall fear your God. Rabbi Elazar explains it slightly differently, but still takes this hierarchy and accepts the hierarchy that wronging a person with words is worse than wronging a person with money. Namely, when you wrong somebody with words, you're hitting them directly into their person. Right? Which is just so true. Vizeba mamono. But when we are talking about ona at mamon, wronging with money, you're simply hurting a person's pocketbook. A person's integrity in their self is more than their pocketbooks. So that, according to the second opinion of Rabbi Elazar, is why ona'at varim is worse than ona'at mamon. Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachmani now, again, has another analysis of why the hierarchy. Zenitan lahishavon. This one, monetary wrongdoing, you can correct. But when you hurt somebody with your mouth, you can't correct it. Once you've let a bad word get out of your mouth, unfortunately it's forever. You can try and make amends. Sometimes it kind of works, but it's much, much, much more difficult the task to be able to undo the wrongs of the mouth than to undo the wrongs of a monetary transaction. Now, keep in mind, I think it's important just to remember what we've said before, that in addition, what is not being said here is that the ona'at mamon, the wrongdoing of money, as we define it and as we have learned, doesn't involve any act of intent to do wrong. Right, so they're not bringing that in, but I think that really is material to why one is at a higher level than the other. Here, in the ona'at devarim, there is certainly, or the Talmud seems to understand, that there is an intention to do wrong. So in fact, on those scales, I would add yet, Rabbi Wexler says the following. All right? That there, in one case, there is no intention. In the other case, there is an intention to do wrong. Okay? Yes, ma'am.
Well, for money, there was laws, and they
Correct.
You can correct.
You can get restitution.
But, correct. I mean, but are there any laws? Is there anything that you can do as penance for?
Oh yes. First of all, you have to apologize. A lot of Yom Kippur. That's the Yom Kippur material, correct? In the Mishnah of Yom Kippur, the Mishnah of Yom Kippur says, if you have wronged somebody, you cannot just go and ask God for forgiveness. First, you have to go to your neighbor, and you have to say, I did this and this to you, and I am sorry that I did it. Okay? And then your neighbor has to forgive you. It's the other side of it. And if he doesn't forgive, you have to go again. But then the Mishnah says there's a limit how many times you have to go. Because at a certain point, your neighbor is not doing his job. If a person wants to be forgiven, you have to be able to forgive them too. Some people find that even more difficult than asking for forgiveness, is to forgive somebody who asks for forgiveness. Okay? So all of that is involved.
Yeah, but in addition, I also wanted to say that I think that if you could do these things unwittingly too, you could go in and ask for the price without knowing.
Oh yes, no question about it. Then it would be a question. Correct. That's correct.
Not necessarily.
Correct. I think what the Baraita has described is not unwitting. It is similar to many other cases where, in fact, what the Talmud is discussing is the intentional, the volitional aspect of wrongdoing. And that having been said, we then would say, well, what if you do that without the intention? Right? In the time of the temple, you would bring a korban chatat for that reason. You bring a sin offering for that reason. And a sin offering is brought for an unintentional act, not an intentional act. Right? An intentional act is different. That's expiated differently. And exactly. That then is turned into liturgy on Yom Kippur because we no longer have that system. So instead, our system of penance, takes the place of that. Okay? Yes?
In the Seder Yisro Shabbos, on the end of the Amida, there's those two English paragraphs.
Netzol shanim eras fatay midaber
mirma. My foes who are plotting against me shouldn't succeed.
Right.
And then there's the line before it about spreading lies about me.
Right.
So I have always found those amazingly intriguing as a mindset of how you would have a prayer such as this, and that this prayer itself would be acknowledged on Shabbos. So there's multiple.
It's acknowledged. It's every time you said the Amida, three times a day.
Thank you. It was my lack of knowledge. So we'll go on after I confess to that.
Okay.
So the part that is striking to me now in this conversation, and this is a great leap, so just try to help me frame it correctly, that you're talking here about unintentional, and yet our rabbis understood intensely about intentionality, and here I would argue the word that Mark used before, inclination, is an operative word, that the world was filled with people, that the people do experience the world as filled with people willing to, quote-unquote, harm them.
Go ahead, let her finish, yes. Good, you're good.
So I'm just trying to put all these pieces together. I'm not exactly sure what my next full point is, but I was intrigued to understand if you could comment on that prayer.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. The assumption is, realize that there's a certain behavioral assumption behind what we're reading now, and I think that you're sensitive to it, and that is that people can and do willingly do evil. And that's not a necessary assumption. I can imagine constructing a worldview where people do not willingly do evil. That they only unwillingly do evil. It's always somebody else's fault, let's say. But in Talmudic psychology, the Talmudic psychology is such that people have free will and in fact are inclined maybe or intend for whatever reason to do what is wrong. And it serves a variety of desires that they have. And that is part of the human makeup. That's when we mentioned before the Yetzer Hara. In Talmudic psychology, the Yetzer Hara plays that role. It is, as it were, some internal desire to do wrong. Right? Now, of course, the notion of wrong itself presupposes that one is aware of right and wrong. There is something that drives us in a way that's destructive toward others, destructive maybe even toward ourselves, and this is universal in human behavior. Right? So there is absolutely true what you're saying, that in Talmudic psychology this is presumed. It's also probably presumed in a lot of modern psychology, because when you are dealing with the notion of free human beings, of freedom, you always then have to go to what the sources are of wrongdoing, let's say of hurting. So yes, you see that reflected in many places. You see it reflected in that prayer in particular, where it's repeated 3 times daily. And I think that this notion of intentionality, I'm more comfortable with intentionality, that is very basic as well to what we are reading here in Onna Atavarim.
Say right before the Shema, daily prayer. Say a prayer, protect us from evil men. From
correct.
Evil
companions. In the very beginning of the daily service, you say, protect us from, and any of you who might have been listening, that was my sermon this year on Yom Kippur, Kol Nidrech. Okay. So not many people were probably listening. It's a time which is very good for sleeping. but that was the source that I used. Yes.
It's interesting in law that we somebody who does a wrongdoing by something improper with money, they can be prosecuted in the courts, but yet a harmful word, which is really more hurtful, is not something that you can
correct.
Prosecute.
A very interesting question, because now here we're moving I think from law to ethics. And when we've made that transition from law to ethics, it's not obvious that there should be a transition. Part of us wants to feel that you should be able to prosecute for those things as well. And yet that's not how it works. In many cases, of course, there is an ultimate judge who can prosecute. And we do have to render an account at some point. Okay? Maybe on a regular basis, on a daily basis, maybe on a yearly basis. Right? Part of the Rosh Hashanah psychology is this notion of rendering accounts to a judge that, in fact, will decide what's appropriate in the circumstance. But it's not a human court. It's absolutely true that it's not a human court.
And that, we could say that that's why that was put in.
Well, maybe.
Yeah. But that it has to be
what interests me here is, I mean, we're analyzing this, maybe overanalyzing this. I think one of the things to keep in mind here is the possibility of hyperbole in the text. That is to say, that certain things are exaggerated. Now, I will allow myself to think along those lines. That sometimes a text engages in exaggeration. And frequently it will do that in order to proscribe behavior for which there really is no legal alternative. Okay? So it will say, you think this is bad, or this is worse. The other thing is worse. It happens to be the thing that's worse. Maybe it's not worse. maybe it's really not worse. That as far as the ultimate rendering of human life goes, the monetary problems are really worse. That the world would, you know, it shouldn't exaggerate it like this. But I think that one of the things that you see here is the Agadah. It is characteristic of Agadah to occasionally engage in what I call hyperbole. It's the hyperbole of expression. It's the kind of thing that can't bear and needn't bear too much analysis, because the point is clear. The point is clear that you are trying to encourage people to act in a certain ethical manner, and that's the point of it. You know, That's a good thing to do. It's an important thing to do. It makes sense to do that. Move on to the next thing. But don't forget this one, okay? So I think that part of these comparisons, and you will see that more of them are going to come up here, part of it is to engage in this type of hyperbole, and maybe the reason sometimes is to emphasize the thing for which there is no recourse in law.
In our world, these do come to a point, although with certainly not a head-on point, but they do come to a point in life where we slam the law.
Yeah, correct. There is a point. And we have that too. Right.
The impact of the assault on the person's integrity or stature. So they do meet at that point, but obviously it's also very different, and we
also don't know how to handle many things except legally.
Yeah.
Because we have lost the religious framework. I'll give you an example. I'll confess my sins to you. This morning I'm in a doctor's office. You can see I got some stuff here. So, as sometimes happens, you end up waiting. If I charged him the way he charged me, for the amount of time that I was waiting today, it would be a different story. I wouldn't have waited so long. So I'm waiting there. So what happens? There's a television that's on. So I must say, in my whole life, I've seen parodies of what I saw this morning for the first time in my whole life. I have seen parodies on Saturday Night Live, but often all I know of a lot of television is Saturday Night Live, because once in a while I watch that, so I get to see parodies, but I never see the original. I'm telling you. So for the first time, I saw today Regis Philbin and some airhead lady whose name I don't know. What is that name? This was so ridiculous that people make money. That America wants, listens to this. These people are successful. The rest of us are shamils, and they're successful. I mean, you know, it does clear your head a little bit. It does clear your head. You realize that something is going on that people like me have little understanding of. But they're the world, and I'm not. I'm not living in some sort of stratosphere. So I'm looking at this Regis and this, what is her name?
Kelly.
Whatever it is. Kelly. So the conversation is extremely low. I mean, this is really the bottom, it's the pits. The things that they're talking about.
You're insulting someone over here who likes her.
I'm sure you'll forgive me. Please forgive me. So they get into this conversation. I can't believe what's happening. About there's a little boy and a little girl. It must be four or five years old. And it all turns into this little boy must be in love with a little girl. And they're holding hands. And this boy must have eyes on her and wants to make it with her. I'm getting to a point. I'm getting angry now. And I see the way in which children are sexualized. That children 4 and 5 years old are being discussed by these adults. Regis, God knows how old this guy is. I don't know how old she is. She doesn't look too old. But the idea here is the sexualization of 4 and 5 year olds in talking about their desires and all. And I cannot tell you how repulsive that whole thing is to me. That children cannot live in a world where they're children. That they cannot be other than sexual creatures. That they can't just be stupid and have fun. And be wrong and right. It's just another... I have such a different view of the world, and it offends me so that you know, I will not be surprised if 10 years from now, you know, we will be at the place where Greek philosophy was in its time of believing in pederasty. You know, it's only a matter of time. I can see, I've lived long enough that I've seen one thing go to another, and here I see little children who are being treated on national television as sexual objects. So, what does this say to me? It says that this is a world where frankly, the religious values are not functioning. Can anybody take you to court for that? Well, that's the way we would think about it, we Americans. Has someone transgressed the law? Should there be laws against this? I don't think about it that way. I think about it very differently. I think about it as the need for people to develop a consciousness of right and wrong, which is rooted in religious traditions, where, in fact, it's a very complex set of values, which takes a lifetime, really, to deal with. And it involves us teaching children as well as we're learning throughout our adult lives as well. But the need to have a section of life which is not governed by law, but which is in effect constructed out of ethics and morality, is, it seems to me, crucial. And when you don't have that, you have what I saw on the television this morning. And I'm sure what I saw, because it was just a matter of bad luck, that I was exposed to what everybody is watching day in and day out, and what is making people rich and famous. This must be going on all over the place. So I find it profoundly disturbing. But that's, you know, we need, religion encompasses both sides of this picture. Religion is this conversation about ultimate values. And that's a conversation that never ends, by the way. It's not as just as if, you know, religion says this or that. That's the way it's parodied in American society. Well, the, you know, religion says all these ridiculous things. The Bible says, and the Bible people say that, you know, everybody else is a heretic. And surely this religion has nothing to, very little to do with that kind of thinking. But it does assume that there is a side of life which is not necessarily governed by law, which is constantly involved in a quest for doing what is right and ethical. Yes.
It is a fact in all societies that the first attitudes of any person originates in childhood by what the parents say. So the children, as they grow up, imitate or copy or follow the ideas of the parents. And it's not necessarily the kid's own development of thought.
So I say to that, God help us and save us. Right? Because it's true. It's true. Let's go on. That was something of a tangent. Okay? Now, we go on. We go on here. Tani Tana Kame de Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak. Tana taught the following in the presence of Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak. Kol Hamalbin Penecha Ve'Rabba Rabim. Here we're moving on again in this general idea of using words to hurt. So anyone who literally, malbin et panei chaviro, who causes his friend's face to become white, that is to say, embarrasses him. Now it's interesting because there's a level, in English at least, where we talk about blushing. That's where your face becomes red. All right, white is worse. Exactly. Right, exactly. White is worse, exactly. Ki'ilu shofech damim. And just from a literary perspective, it's very beautifully done. When you cause the person's face to turn white, it's as if you have spilled their blood. All right, of course, if you spill the person's blood, they're white. There's no color left. Amar lei. So Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak says to the Tana, Shapir ka'amrat, you have said, spoken well. You have spoken well. The chazina lei de azil sumka va'ati chivra. Because I have seen how the red face turns into white. Okay? I've seen it happen. Amar le Abaya le Rav Dimi, Abaya says to Rav Dimi, Bima Arava b'mai zehire. About what are they careful in the West? Namely, these are Babylonian Amoraim talking about the rabbis of the land of Israel. So they say, what are the rabbis in the land of Israel really particularly careful about? Amar le, Rav Dimi answers, because Rav Dimi used to go between the two. He was called in one of the Nechute. That means he would go down to, he would go up to Israel and then down to Babylonia. And he was frequently a source of the traditions in the land of Israel, as later were then taught in Babylonia. Amar le, Rav Dimi says to him, when asked, you know, what's really important in the land of Israel, be'achvare ape, being careful about not embarrassing people. The Amar Rabbi Chanina, as Rabbi Chanina says, Hakol yordim legeinom chutz mishlosha. As Rabbi Chanina says, everybody goes to Gehenim except for three. Here, that's again, Talmudic hyperbole. Everybody goes to Gehenim for three. Now, of course, that seems incomprehensible. He goes on, Hakol sata datach. You really mean everybody goes to Gehenim? Everybody goes to hell? That's what we're talking about here? Ella Ema Kol Hayordim de Gehenom. No, rather what it means is everybody who goes down to Gehenim, Olin, eventually goes up. Right? Gehenim is sort of a punishment for sin. And you will survive Gehenim. It sort of purifies. Gehenim purifies. So you go down to Gehenim, the fires of Gehenim purify you, and then you go up. Chutz mishlosha, except three never make it up. Right? Either they never make it up, or in the art scroll comment here is, they don't make it up for a long time. Right? Either one. All right? Shiordin ve'en olim, who go down and don't go up. Ve'eluhem, these are they. Haba'al eshet ish, a man who has sexual relations with a married woman. V'hamalbin penecha v'rabba rabim, and a person who embarrasses somebody else in public. V'hamechane shem ralach averro, and someone who calls his friend an embarrassing nickname. What are you talking about? These three are on the same level. Here you see, a person who sleeps with his neighbor's wife, for that, in fact, there is recourse in the system, right? That, you get the death penalty for. Right, so, in a way, that's an easy call.
Yeah, but you still go to
Gehenno. You still go to Gehenno, and you stay there.
Right.
Okay?
Some are not so, okay. If they're not, they're gone.
All right, and now, these others are situations where, in fact, there is no recourse in law. The first one is one that we've just mentioned. We understand that the embarrassment, making somebody feel bad, and a more extreme case of that, embarrassing them in public.
Well, that is, of course, that is libel, and that is compensable.
Well, what is libel?
Slander, rather.
Slander. What's slander? Slander is not embarrassing somebody.
Well,
something could be true, and it's still embarrassing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Okay, so here we're talking about something is totally true, and you're not even supposed to say it. Now, I must say, to the credit of my friends in the land of Israel, I can tell you my neighbors in Jerusalem abide by this to this day. It's very difficult to get a straight answer from them about a lot of things. Because they will not say anything that's disparaging. Very interesting. Yeah, I noticed this with my friends. There's a whole group of people that I relate to on a regular basis who simply will not say things that are disparaging.
And for people,
because it's Lashon Hara, correct. Now that's, well, I'm not going to go all the way into that direction. What is the definition of Lashon Hara? But here, we're already seeing the virtues of the land of Israel. I'm just making a comment to say that even today, I have seen these things functioning in the land of Israel. But here you can see now three things juxtaposed. one of which I would have thought was absolutely obvious, the second one of which is partially obvious, the third one of which is not in any way obvious, and they're all put in the same level as being the worst possible things in this world. Okay? Now, my reading of it is, again, that you're dealing now, you are seeing hyperbole used for the sake of ethics in the community. That there is a notion here of being sensitive to other people's feelings. And since that is not something that you can prosecute for, and it is not something that is absolutely obvious in the text, in fact, what the rabbis do is develop a complex network of agadah, and I underline that, of agadah, of teaching, to teach everyone that this is wrong. You teach it to children, you teach it to adults, everybody learns to guard their tongue. And what you said before, guard my tongue from evil and my lips from speaking guile. That's what you are reading at the end of the Amidah. That's how it begins. Guard my tongue from evil and my lips from speaking guile. Okay? That in a religious system is a concern. And here you see it in the Agadah, where it is used even hyperbolically in order to make the case that this is something that's very serious business. Now, in a moment, we'll say a little bit more about what it means to be mechane et chavero, to call somebody by a nickname. Yes?
I may be misremembering this, but isn't there a Talmudic description of the cause of the fall of Jerusalem being connected to an insulting or
exactly.
Embarrassing someone?
Correct. This was the story of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. That Kamsa was invited, and there was a guy named Bar Kamsa. There were two guys named Bar Kamsa. The wrong guy got the invitation. He came to the meal, and Kamsa says to him, "What are you doing here?" So he embarrasses him, and he keeps doing it again and again. And finally, Bar Kamsa gets so upset, he goes out and he tells the Romans what's going on. And so it leads ultimately to the destruction of the city. So this is Agadah. This is the way the Agadah functions. The Agadah creates comparisons, it creates stories, all in order to inculcate certain religious values which have to do with the importance and the value of every single human life. Okay? Now, to look at this last example, the Gemara says, Nechaneh hainu malbin. Isn't nicknaming somebody the same as embarrassing him? Now, what nicknaming must mean? That's exactly it. Nicknaming is not a good translation into English. It just means taunting. And indeed, sometimes kids do that all the time. And there's a very common thing that kids do, is if another child has an unusual physical feature, let's say, the kids will use that constantly to destroy the well-being of the child. And we know anybody who's been a teacher or camp counselor.
Or a child.
Or a child. If you have any memories of this, you know what we're talking about. So when I say that I'm sort of going different ages here, I really think that some of this ultimately is for the sake of teaching children. It's for the sake of teaching adults. I'm not sure which is which and when is which. But it's our entire complex now. We're making sure that we don't use language to taunt others. And a common way in which it is done is by using disparaging names that, in fact, are effective in making people feel very bad. That's just another form of ona'at devarim. Okay? Yes.
There is a saying, Tov Shem Tov Mishemen Tov. Here we are learning how one not supposed to badmouth or do on advarim against anybody else. Is the Talmud teaching us or any chapter about how somebody can protect his Shem Tov?
Shem Tov is good name.
Yeah.
So there, when it says Tov Shem Tov
Mishemen Tov. Good name from better than good money.
Well, better than good oil.
Oh, yeah.
Better than good oil. and it doesn't mean black oil, it means olive oil. In other words, in a society that really appreciates the value of oil, a good name is really worth much more. So that's its function, that's its meaning in that context, is to say that it's not monetary things, it's not physical things, but it's a reputation that ultimately is of tremendous significance. So indeed, that too. This is part of the complex of ideas. Last week I spoke to you about value concepts. Value concepts sort of work in an integrated fashion. You've given another one that is not exactly the same thing, but is somewhat related to it. The importance of a good name. Right? That's related here. It's not the same thing as calling somebody by a disparaging name. That really has a different force to it. That's a way of taunting somebody. Okay? If you were to follow this proper track of behavior, ideally you would become somebody who had a shame tov. You would have a good reputation. And people respect people who are careful with their language, who do not taunt others. We believe that ultimately the person who acts and behaves appropriately, positively, and lovingly will be the better person. Right? That's Tov Shem Mishem and Tov. Is a mensch. Very good way to say it. Yes?
I was very interested in the anecdote regarding the TV interview, and I watch TV.
And God help you.
And what is very disconcerting in the way we seem to operate now is that people can say anything that they want, whether it be factual, whether it be cruel, whether it be nasty, and it's understood as their opinion. This is my opinion. And so it becomes almost impossible to litigate any of these comments that you hear all the time, and it is a relaxation of the law that allows persons to express their own opinion without any concept of responsibility. So how do you handle that type of thing?
Well, I would go even further. I would say it's not only a legal issue. That's what I'm trying to stress here,
right.
that it's an issue of ethics. And ethics are not necessarily the same as law. And here, my own sense is that in our own society, really the more you hurt, the more you're rewarded. To a great extent, there is a reward for hurting. It is true in the media. There's a certain type of media where if you are outlandish, and part of that outlandishness involves attacking somebody,
right.
That's all part of the game. That's what makes people interesting. Right? Tzaddikim are not interesting.
But you can't go after them because it's their opinion.
So maybe the real issue is not just what you can say, but what you should say. That's what I'm trying to... I think that the world of ethics is not only what you can and can be prosecuted for,
right.
Having, but what you should be saying or not saying.
Why the law... I was wondering why they didn't go and make the bridge, okay, between the Agadah and the Halakha by taking these things that are wrong in terms of not slandering... What did you say, Bobby, just before? Taunting or something like that, and turn that into law with penalties. For example, in our society, we've gone the step of making this whole area of hate crimes, okay,
mm-hmm.
part of our legal system now.
You can do some of that, and believe me, the Talmud does a lot of it. To say that the Talmud doesn't have law in it wouldn't be true.
I didn't say that.
Okay, it's mostly law. But I'm simply saying that in any system, in any society, law is not everything. That Agadah also plays a part in the development of proper behavior. The articulation of behavior, the teaching of behavior, and the striving of individuals to do what is good and right in the sight of God. I think that the Agadah plays an important role. Part of this teaching has nothing to do with law. It has to do with the telling of stories. Because much of this is storytelling. I think that that's really what we're engaging in here. Much of it, you'll see more storytelling that's going to be coming up. Storytelling, and it's making comparisons, it's hyperbole occasionally. All of that is just part and parcel of a system that is simply much more complex than law.
I was going to suggest to us all that the contemporary view of Akadah is the internet, where bloggers, if you want to give the idea of people being able to say outlandish things, and then there's another side that comes back.
Very good.
You're and there right. is some attempt, if you would, at moderating what each side is willing or able, I should say, to persuade others of. Now, the problem is it takes a huge amount of time to be able to encompass all the information on blogs. But I think it's an attempt by society to do some modulation of the hyperbole.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the rabbis are doing it through their discussion here. But they're also, in this annual now sequence of Obama's first year of the administration, a poll that came out. And the interpretation by Peter Hunter's poll was people's dissatisfaction with Obama is because he does not manipulate us enough. And that we want our politicians to manipulate.
I wait to see all of these polls. See what we learn from.
I suggested because it's part of all the Haggadah is a form of manipulation which is appealing to the human psyche also.
Yes. Yes.
Is there implicit in this discussion, let's say the Haggadah aspect of it, a certain kind of wishful thinking on the part of the rabbis, or a kind of fantasizing, because there is a disconnect between, for example, the good name that a person has in his community because he behaves in a way that everyone admires. He's a good person in thought and in action. That reputation of a person who lives that life doesn't go out very far beyond his immediate community. There are people who have very good name and their reputation is worldwide. And very often we know that they're not the same kind of person. They don't behave well. But maybe they're wealthy. Maybe they've been philanthropic. Maybe for the wrong reasons. They want to reach the end of the road. They want to leave something, a name on a hospital, a name on a... So, it sounds in a way like it's something that they would like to be able to coerce people into doing, can't. So, it's, as you said, it's paired with things where you can be coerced, where you can be taken to court and punished severely. And it's made equivalent without any. Even though I'm sure they know that there's no way of making people in that way. And in fact, very often, not because of Yetzer Hara, but because of the way of the world, there's a all those wonderful young people who, pardon me, flock to work on Wall Street for investment banks, where they could be using their wisdom, their education, their upbringing, and completely divorced. I don't blame them. Well, I do. But it's the world we live in. If you're talking about developing a spiritual inner life, you're also talking about, in some way, withdrawing from it. You can't confront every day the kinds of things you saw on television, deal with the kind of people who are living in that world, and at the same time be focused on your own idea of how you should want to develop as a human being, how you want to conduct your life, and so on. So, I think the rabbis must have felt the same.
You know, I suppose I'm more hopeful than you are. I think that people can do that. That's why people go to a synagogue. That's why people study. And people do it. You're here. You know, perfect example. That people want more. And people realize that, yes, making a living is important. I think it's true all up and down the corporate ladder. It's true all up and down different businesses that many individuals are engaged and they are thinking about these issues. This is not something that you know, only a few people have said. I think that many people are hungering for more in their lives. It's true across the board. I suspect if I were going to make an investment, that I'd invest in some of these things. Because I really think with the need.
That, but I'm saying that at some point they come into conflict.
Oh, yeah. Yes. No, they may indeed. But probably that's true in every person's life. I wouldn't only cite the bad guy. In every human life as such, I know one of the interesting things about growing older is that you keep seeing situations and you keep realizing that there are mistakes that you make in your life which you would think you would never make. You're not supposed to make them, and you're smart enough not to make them, and you wouldn't make them, and you can't make them, and you make them. Now, I have absolutely no decent explanation for this. Things that happen to you, the Talmud says in the following way, it says, the Mishnah says, "Al tamein ba'atzmecha ad yom motcha." This is the Talmud says. Do not trust yourself until the day you die.
So
a man says, he says, no, that's not the right reading. It should say, "Al tamein ba'atzmecha ad ziknutcha." Don't trust yourself until you get old. Because when you're old, you are beyond all these things. So he gets old. He teaches this, and comes a beautiful woman to offer herself to this guy. So he has no resistance. Bless him. Or curse, I don't know what to say. He gives into the woman. After this is all over, he says, "No, I taught the Talmud wrong. I should have said, Al tamein ba'atzmecha, don't trust yourself until the day you die. Even if you're old, you can't be trusted." So that's the point.
I think the media plays actually a very interesting and complex role in our society. We don't have a state religion, so we don't have a normative set of ethical values, and we have so many different cultures, cheek to jowl, that I actually believe that the media every day plays out a morality story to redefine the center of American ethical behavior. And the blogs and all of the rest of it actually plays into the recreation or the modification of American ethical values, whether it's Katrina or or just the tragedy that just occurred.
See, I got that writ large.
Or whether or not it's Monica Lewinsky, or each of these are our Torah equivalent stories on which we define American ethical values, because we don't have a single way of actually adjudicating them. And that's why when you'll see the Harry Reid story this week, you see people are all over the place in terms of their reaction to it, because there really isn't a single world view that we have. So we struggle, and that's why the media remains powerful and captures people's imagination, because people are desperate to find where they are in that ethical spectrum.
I would just add the one caveat from my perspective, and that is, I think it's different if you have people coming from different, let's say, ethically based worlds. You've got Jews, and you've got Catholics, and you've got Protestants, and you've got people from this part of the world, you know, Indians and Chinese and, you know, all kinds of stuff like that, okay? And let's say the Chinese are well-grounded in Confucius. And the Japanese are well-grounded in whatever the Japanese are. And the Catholics are well-grounded in the church, in the Catholic Church, and so on. I'm going to go on with all that. And then we need something to enable us to create that melting pot from all these different places. What I'm afraid of is that nobody's grounded. There is no grounding. And what, to whatever extent the great traditions of the world in a way distill wisdom, it cannot be distilled in a moment, but can be distilled only in 5,000 years, probably. And so it probably takes about that time, anywhere between 2,000 and 5,000 years, to be able to work a lot of these issues out. If that were what we were talking about, I would say, you know, this would be a terrific system. But I'm afraid that this is, in fact, instead of, this functions in place of these traditions. And that, I think, creates something somewhat different. Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, we will go on next week. And next week, by the way, next week, oh yes, next week is the Lucy Davidovich lecture, so we will not go on with this next week. That will be given by Professor David Ruskies. I hope you will come to that. It will be, I'm sure, a wonderful lecture.